It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine. 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us this morning, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief vet at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Hello, good morning.
Morning, we'll stick with the morning part. All right, Trace in New Milford. I have a female spayed cat, about 1.5, a rescued stray. This past month, I've noticed that her urine smells very strongly of ammonia, a much, much stronger smell than it used to be. I have not changed the type or brand of her litter, and I have not changed her eating habits. I've noticed that lately she likes to drink more water than she used to, but I consider that normal since it's been hot lately. I also take care to always have water out for her. What could be causing this smell?
That strong smell in urine can be a couple of things, possibly an increase in the concentration of the urine. So it has been very hot. She may be drinking more water, but it's possible that she's not drinking enough to keep up with the losses of water through the heat, because of heat. So animals lose water through metabolism, but they also can lose through their mouths, the mucous membranes of the mouth, and the bottoms of their feet, and sometimes through the surface on the inside of the ears as well. So if there's lots of heat and lots of loss that way, even with more drinking, you can have a very concentrated urine, and that can have a stronger smell. The urine smell will also change sometimes with urinary tract infection. So the increase in water drinking can be a sign of urinary tract infection as well. Many cats will also use a different place in the house than the litter pan, so I would watch for that as well. If you're finding urine in other places in the house, it's also possible that just a small change in food can cause problems. So if your cat's used to eating a whole can of cat food and now they're eating gradually a half a can and making up for it with dry food, that can also cause the urine to be more concentrated. And cats who are prone to producing crystals in their urine, so they precipitate these crystals when their urine is thick and not dilute enough, so that's another possibility. Those cats who have a lot of crystals in the urine tend to be irritated by them and, again, will not use the litter pan. They presumably make the association with the pan and discomfort, and so they'll start to go in the bathtub or in the sink or at the top of the stove or in the clean laundry basket. That seems to be a really popular one. So having a urine sample checked, having your cat checked and having a urine sample checked is really important with that smell, for sure.
Do you sit around vet school laughing about asking for a urine sample for a cat?
No. Well, at vet school, I can remember years ago at vet school, of course, we, you know, as students, that was our job to collect urine samples. So we had to do, 25 cystocin TCs a day. So that's putting a needle into the bladder through the body wall. It's a non-painful procedure, gets the urine right away, doesn't cause any problems. So that's the preferred way. And you can try to collect it at home, but, you've already got, many times when cats have urinary tract infection, you already have a cat who's a little nervous. Either they're sick and they don't feel well and they're starting to hide or be nervous, or their urinary habits have changed, and they know that they're not supposed to urinate outside the box and it's making them nervous, or whatever's made them urinate outside the box is another cat who's not being nice to them, or a cat outdoors, or a bear through the yard, and all these things make them emotionally upset. Then you lock them in a room with a litter pan that doesn't have litter in it and maybe has some plastic pellets, and they really, some cats will use that box, and people can collect the sample, and everything's fine. Many cats, we end up collecting samples in the hospital.
So I guess what I'm saying in a roundabout way is, if you have one of those cats, or if you don't have experience, if something's going on, it's entirely worth, for everybody's peace of mind. If the vet says they need a, you know, if, for example, Teresa New Milford has these issues, just take the cat in and have them collect the urine. Because
yes, and we need to do an exam anyway. So, yeah, so if the bladder has a little bit of urine in it, we can usually collect it at the same time. So we've got to do that exam. I don't treat animals based on just their urine sample. So it usually works out. So the problem being sometimes is that bladder is completely empty. And if it's early in the morning, I prefer to have these cats come early in the morning because then we can keep them for the day and collect the sample later on, send them home.
Right. So anyway, that's just a side thing because, you know, once you've got cats and urine in the same sentence,
you want to get on it.
Exactly.
Yeah, you want to get on it right away because with this issue, if your cat starts to feel uncomfortable, even a super concentrated urine, I have seen some cats that will start to urinate outside of the litter pan. And once they do, you know, that spot, even though you clean it with your anti-icky poo and everything else,
yeah, it's never going to be the same.
It's never going to be the same. So it's best to nip that before it ever happens.
That's where I was going with this. Thank you. All right. Dan in Bristol wants to know, and he didn't ask me, he asked you. So how do you know when it's time to clip your dog's claws?
Typically, it's when they start to make noise. And so the claws should be up off the floor, in my opinion, up off the pavement. So it's hard to tell if you walk your dog on grass all the time. But being in the house, you should be able to. You should not hear those claws clicking on the floor. Because if they're hitting the floor, they're causing the toes to be raised up off the floor, which sets off their balance. Especially important in older dogs or dogs with arthritis. Especially important with dogs who have arthritis in their toes. Super, super painful to have those toes hyperextended by long toenails if you've got arthritis in your toes.
Huh. All right. I have always used my grandmother, may she rest in, a serious piece from seriously many, many years ago, you know, would always dress and she would wear high heels and you could hear her coming because she would click.
So is that a good thing? You needed to hear her come?
No. It was just one of those. It didn't really register on any level except that I've had dogs, as you know, for quite some time, and when I start hearing them click, I'm like,
yes,
and nails.
And you know, many times you can pick it up before they start to click if you know what you're looking for. Especially if your dog has clear nails, you can see the white nails. You can see the click, and when you've got that little hook on the end, you know, not a bad idea to get them clipped prior to trying to make an appointment once they're clicking on the floor.
Well, all right. Loretta in Millbrook, our 8-year-old, otherwise healthy Golden, unexpectedly had 2 grand mal seizures in 2 weeks. Our vet put her on a low dose of phenobarbital, and we had a full blood workup done. Everything came back normal, but the thyroid T4 was at the low end of normal. 1.7, where he said 1.2 was the cutoff. He then decided to put her on some Suloxone, just in case. Since then, Bailey's very tired and sleeping a lot of the time. She's eating and drinking way more than usual, and when jumping on and off the bed. She's eating and drinking way more than usual. Most concerning to me is that she is stumbling around a bit, tripping up and down stairs and when jumping on and off the bed. Also, she's grumpy, which she's never been before. She's always been wonderful and endlessly patient around our kids, but yesterday she growled at the youngest. Could the meds be at fault?
So, a couple of things here. What is her name, Bailey?
Yes, Bailey.
So the symptoms that are being described are mostly, I believe, from the phenobarbital, absolutely, and not uncommon when you start a dog on phenobarbital. So it's a tough call because if your dog is having grand mal seizures and, you know, a couple in 2 weeks, you want to make a difference in the seizures. It can be very dramatic and very upsetting for people. And so tend to start on a more moderate to high dose than low dose because it takes a while for the phenobarbital to build up in their system enough to help to prevent the incidence. So So what phenobarbital does is it usually doesn't make seizures go away, but it spreads them out and it makes them less severe. So you want to decrease the incidence and the severity and the length of seizures. So when they first go on phenobarbital, it's not unusual for them to be super hungry, lethargic, sleeping a lot. They tend to then produce enzymes in the liver that breaks down the phenobarbital over time, and so that after about 2 to 3 weeks, those symptoms will go away. So that is not something that's unusual. The second thing is...
the siloxia.
So as far as tripping and falling and all that, you really need to have the warning about keeping your dog safe for that period of time. So you may need to move things around and keep your dog downstairs. And if you need to bring her up for bedtime, walk with her on a leash, and block off the top of the stairs or close the bedroom door so she doesn't have free roam of the house. Jumping on and off the bed, again, you know, some people will sleep on the floor. You can help her on the bed if you're pretty sure that she's going to stay on the bed all night. So she needs extra care for those 2 weeks when she's getting... her system's getting used to the phenobarb. The other thing is that thyroid medication based on a total T4, presumably of 1.7, I would recommend that the dog have a more complete thyroid profile. So what we're looking at is lots and lots of things can cause, with concurrent illness, can cause a low total T4. What you need is the other information. So the TSH, or thyroid-stimulating hormone, typically in true hypothyroidism, is running high because it keeps on telling the thyroid to produce hormone, and it's not. So it's a negative and a positive feedback system. So you need more information in order to just treat your dog for thyroid, for hypothyroidism, and it can complicate the issues. So it can be an expensive test panel. I usually send mine either to California or to Michigan State, but it totally is worth it so that you have a diagnosis of whether you have true hypothyroidism or not. And when you start two medications at the same time, it can be confusing as well. So my recommendation is to go back and ask for that full thyroid panel if it hasn't been done to verify whether you need to actually give thyroid medication.
Is that what Siloxin?
Siloxin. Mm-hmm. It's a thyroid supplement.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then to read more about the effects of phenobarbital. You know, the other take on this is that can you really predict whether you're helping if your dog's only ever had two seizures in 2 weeks? So some dogs will have two seizures in 2 weeks, and then they won't have another seizure for a year and a half. And so will you know if your phenobarbital is doing anything? So if people can wait and the seizures haven't been dangerously long or severe, then, I won't always recommend starting on medication right away. But that is a personal choice and probably a conversation that's been had already.
Yeah, and then we don't know how many kids they have and how many dogs and how many other things.
Right, and of course, keeping her away from children if she's getting growly is really important. I don't think in my experience I've had that problem with phenobarbital. But you've got the mixture of those two medications there, and Siloxin can make people, I know from personal experience, irritated if you're taking too much.
Yeah.
You need to revisit all of this.
So the short answer is, because it's funny, because the crux of the question is which I think is quite clever of her, is could the meds be at fault? The short answer is yes,
absolutely.
The meds could absolutely be contributing to all of this, but it needs to be, with that clarity, the whole thing then needs to be revisited and teased apart and...
Absolutely, especially
sort
with a
of
dog who's so miserable.
Yeah, and if you've had 8 years, and I'm speaking now just as A, a civilian, and B, someone who has had, you know, a major seizure dog, it's completely disruptive, but it's also, you've got to give it enough time to see what happens and see what you're dealing with. And the whole thing with seizures is that they can't really be, they're not, they're erratic. They just are.
Right, whether they're on medication or not, yep. sometimes. But yeah, so it's a scary problem, but it definitely warrants another visit to the veterinarian for a long conversation and maybe another blood test.
Yep. All right, Caleb in Kingston, our 8-month-old Yorkie Henry has been limping and seems like he's in pain. The first opinion we got was that he likely had, I'm not sure how to pronounce this,
leg Perthes disease is what it's called.
All right, leg cab Perthes disease or leg Perthes. Can you talk about what the treatment options are and what are the long-term effects?
So first I'll explain the disease itself. So this is a young Yorkshire Terrier, which is pretty common. It's not a common disease at all, but it is a common presentation for the disease. So that means that very high percentage of dogs with this disease are under about 20 pounds. They're small dogs. They're terriers and toys, basically. And it is leg calf Perthes disease or femoral head necrosis, aseptic necrosis, meaning dying off of the bone without bacteria, without infection. So I think it's named after the people who discovered this in people. Apparently it's a problem with children as well. But in dogs, we see it in young dogs. Males and females are equally affected. And you can mostly, I think you see the symptoms between about 4 to 5 months and about 8 or 9 months. But you can see it even a little bit younger than that and up to about a year or so. That your dog will start to limp. So there's pain in a hind leg, so it has to do with the hip. It is, what happens is, we think, is that spontaneously they start to lose the blood supply to the femoral head, which is the ball on top of the femur. The femur is that the long bone in the top of the leg. So the hip is a ball and socket joint, and the femur provides the ball part of it. The socket is on the pelvis. And the ball on top of the femur starts to degenerate spontaneously, and that is because of lack of blood supply. The blood supply just, either there are clots that happen, it's not fully, the pathogenesis is not fully understood. And then you can get, with time, an actual collapse of the head of the femur, which of course is going to be really painful. So this question is about the treatment options. So the treatment options are conservative treatment to begin with, and it totally depends on the x-ray. So you're making this diagnosis based on x-rays and looking at the ball and the socket joint, and very early on you might see just a little widening of the space between the ball and the socket, and you might see a little mottling of the bone, sort of a moth-eaten appearance. That would be very early on disease and not a collapse of the head of the femur. And that's the best time to make that diagnosis, where you can potentially prevent the progression with preventing the dog from bearing weight, and that means cage rest. So this can be a really devastating disease to a family because you've got a potentially a 4 or 5 month old dog who now has to be in a cage small enough that they're not going to move around. And this can go on for months at a time. If there is a blessing about this, it's because it is that they are very small dogs and can be carried around. So you can carry your dog outside, put a short leash on them, let them go potty. And then they're supposed to come back indoors and go right back in the cage or, you know, be held and not be able to bear weight on that leg. So it is the conservative treatment is pain medication for the pain and potentially some acupuncture, laser therapy, ultrasound therapy, those types of newer rehab or, you know, unconventional therapies are really helpful, too, to help control the pain. We don't know how much they help the blood supply at this point. If you're able to do that for a long enough period of time, then you may have a dog that will not have significant arthritis, and we'll be able to use that. But it can take months. And what you're doing is monitoring the progress with x-rays once a month or so. If the head of the femur has already collapsed and flattened and the whole thing is mottled and it looks like a disaster, then typically, or if your cage rest doesn't work, then typically surgery is the next option. Surgery is called an FHO, and it's a femoral head and neck ostectomy, which means removing the femoral head and neck. And again, the small blessing here is that the smaller the dog, the better they do with an FHO. So they can, once you remove that ball, they can form sort of a false hip there with fibrous tissue. Now, my understanding is that some people are using swimming therapy, water therapy, for dogs. Swimming, I would guess, because it's totally non-weight-bearing, to help them get through this. And certainly that would be a lovely thing for a dog who's locked in. You know, you've got a puppy who's locked in a cage for months and months. It's difficult to socialize them that way. It's difficult to have them move around enough so they don't lose a lot of muscle mass. So it can be a very difficult disease to make that decision about. The tiny breed dogs, too, you know, don't do as well with, just give them a bone or give them a Kong. They don't do as much chewing, so it's hard to entertain them.
So basically the dog would have to become you have to get a little
bed rest.
Sling. A combination of bed rest and sling, and once again, the environment that the dog is in and the lifestyle of the people, you know, play into it.
It does, and the type of dog. You know, if you've got a dog who's going to be crazed in a cage, it's going to be very difficult to do. And how many people are able to swim their dog three times a day to get their energy out? You know, so all of those things you need to be consider. Potentially, if you catch it really early, it might heal more quickly and with less pain. But the idea behind the surgery, if nothing else works, is to remove the source of pain. And dogs after surgery who get rehab therapy can do quite well with a femoral head ostectomy.
All right.
Because they're lightweight.
And that is very cool. Thank you so much, Dr. Cannon. This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.